Okay.
So what we're doing is we're in our third class of the Heart Sutra. We're going through the part that starts with nothing to attain, a bodhisattva depends on prajnaparamita, and ends with complete perfect enlightenment, and then we're stopping. The first thing that comes up for me in looking at this is to ask, what's a bodhisattva? And a bodhisattva is not to be confused with an archetype like Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva of compassion. It is that in one way, but it's also us. And an example of that I was just going through is that the story of Avalokiteshvara is that Avalokiteshvara at one point looked just like, I don't know if you've seen pictures of them, but they looked pretty much like a normal human. And they saved all the people from the hell realms the people had created, had gotten into themselves through their own delusion, and kept looking back and seeing that the hell realms were full. And her head exploded. And then she grew another head and saved a bunch of people, and then grew another head. And eventually, the 10th head, when she saw that the hell realms were full, she realized that was her job, and she grew 11 heads, and she had by that time thousands of arms, each with a hand at the end. That's the image of her to save all the beings. And so to finish the recap, that's us. Doesn't sound like us at first, but when we're in Zazen, we have thoughts that torture ourselves. We have emotions we torture ourselves with, and we create our own hell. And sometimes we settle, but then they come back. And it's our job to just keep sitting in Zazen and being with it, being close. So there we go. You're all caught up now. And the next thing after talking about what a bodhisattva is, it says a bodhisattva depends on prajnaparamita. And and with nothing to... And the mind is no hindrance. Without any hindrance, no fears exist. So what is prajnaparamita? We actually have a chant where we chant a homage to the prajnaparamita that we do in sessions, and we will be doing in the upcoming session. And I think this sheds a bit of light on the subject. Here's how it goes. It goes, homage to the perfection of wisdom, the lovely, the holy. The perfection of wisdom gives light. Unstained, the entire world cannot stain her. She is a source of light, and from everyone in the triple world, she removes darkness. Most excellent are her works. She brings light so that all fear and distress may be forsaken, and disperses the gloom and darkness of delusion. She herself is an organ of vision. She has a clear knowledge of the own being of all dharmas, for she does not stray away from it. The perfection of the Buddhas sets in motion the wheel of the dharma. Now, prajnaparamita, literally translated, means, as you probably figured out, perfection of wisdom. There are six perfections in Buddhism, and wisdom is the highest one. And as you can probably guess by that, by that chant, that homage, it's just not any old ordinary wisdom. So what is that though? If in the back to the Heart Sutra, it says that with nothing to attain, a bodhisattva depends on prajnaparamita, and the mind is no hindrance. A hindrance is often thought of as something that stands in your way, or something which is obscures your vision, the thing that obscures your vision. But if you shine light on the thing that obscures your vision is no longer obscured. So if you're in a room that's pitch black, and then suddenly the light comes on, maybe you don't even expect the light. Suddenly your way is clear. Especially if you're in a forest or something, and if it's pitch black and you turn on the flashlight, suddenly you see that you don't need to fear running into anything. Your road is completely clear. And that way our world of form and emptiness is also clear. Our suffering has been to identify with ourselves. And it's through sitting in Zazen that we can see that the self is not so substantial. Probably not going to completely disappear, but it's not going to be so big either. So that, so in this way, form is empty. It says earlier in the Heart Sutra that the skandhas neither appear nor disappear. So we're not looking for something dramatic. We're not even looking. We're here with something very simple. It says in the homage to the Prajna Paramita that wisdom, that Prajna is a source of light, and from everyone in the triple world, she removes darkness. So she removes the hindrances, which are when we thought that our world was substantial and we thought we were substantial. She brings light so that all fear and distress may be forsaken and disperses the gloom and darkness of delusion. The Heart Sutra says, without any hindrance, no fears exist. So what would that be like? To see that your fears aren't real because of the light shining on them. Paula? You're muted.
A couple of things have been bothering me about this class and this particular part of the sutra. Mm-hmm. The first thing that bothers me is the word depends. Oh. Because
me too.
This sutra is a destroyer of all depends. You can't depend on anything. And in the end, you can depend on this special wisdom, which is the highest wisdom and is the brightest light and a lot of other things that are certainly something to aspire to, but nothing to be pinned down. Mm-hmm. And the idea is there is nothing to be pinned down. So we've come full circle and we're back to no dependencies. So this is radical thinking. Very radical change in the way of thinking. It strikes me as something designed to pull the carpet out from under everything and everyone, yet to bring everyone together and to hold that hope. So this is quite tricky. So, and I've not yet come to grips with this, except for to feel like I'm perched on a high precipice, leaning forward, and to become comfortable with this as a way of life. That's as far as I can get with it currently. And I'm wondering what light you might shed on that.
Well, I'm still struggling with the pens, which to me, that's actually pulling the rug out from under us. That you've just said don't depend on anything. Now it says depend on Prajna Paramita. So I think it's okay to be uncomfortable with that and keep sitting with it. That's one thing. Another thing is it's just a word, after all. It could be a translation issue. I mean, so one way to work with it is, what is depends? What does that mean to me? And to sit with that, why does that bother me? And to let that sink in. Another thing is to note that that is getting attached to words. And another thing that comes up to my mind is that if you imagine there's a Zen saying about jumping off a 100-foot pole. So if you're on that precipice, Is there a you there? And the other thing is, the other is the Prajnaparamita a thing? So what would it mean to depend on something that is not a thing? So we have to use words, and we use the word prajna, we use the word perfection of wisdom, and if we think that it's something elevated above all things, then we've made it a thing, right? So it's not that too. I think that the Heart Sutra could have gone on and on saying, know this, and continued we needed closure. So there's something about needing closure with that. But I'd actually like to see if other people have thoughts on this, or I feel like I'm probably bringing up more questions than I'm answering. Or if you have something more, Paula. Zach.
Similar to that is, it says there's no attainment, and then if you depend on Prajnaparamita and attain unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. So I kind of feel like, I mean, there's these little trick things in there, but there are things you hold on to, or which maybe is a trick on a trick on a trick or something. I kind of feel like the Prajnaparamita, it's like a wisdom from seeing reality, what really is, not what our mind creates and all that, which Okamura called impermanence and egolessness, which maybe I'm getting too deep in the weeds here, but I like that idea of being able to see reality. Good luck, but.
Actually, I wasn't going to bring this up yet, but now that you mentioned reality, I feel like I have to, which is that there's a Zen teacher named Nagarjuna who talked about the doctrine of the two truths. And I think this is really relevant here, because what he talked about was that there's the relative truth and the absolute truth. And they're both true. This is the most important thing that Zen students forget. Even people who've studied a long time forget. There are two truths. And those two truths are that the absolute truth is emptiness, that we're all connected, that there's nothing we can lay a hand on. There's nothing solid in this world, as we've been discussing. And the relative truth. That's the truth that I'm sitting here with you, sort of, virtually, that we're talking to each other, that each of us is sitting on some solid ground. And it's not even one relative truth. It's the relative truth that when I see a stoplight, I think, or a turn a certain color, I think it's green, and my wife thinks it's blue. I mentioned that in last week that in Japanese, blue, they don't really see blue, but the color blue means go. They're both true. And so Prajnaparamita is not see emptiness. It's also not see form. Prajna is not to see just the absolute. It's not just to see the relative. And it's not even to see as an observer. It's to be with both, many, as many realities as there are, as many truths as there are. So I'm sure that just confused you all more, but the thing is to not get attached to the idea that wisdom, that prajna is a thing, not to be attached to the idea of form and emptiness are two things, and that's all there is in the universe, is to be open. So when you're sitting and your mind calms a little, settles a little bit, you might get a glimpse of it. You've probably had plenty of glimpses of it. You may not remember them, but you probably have, as we've talked about in class a couple of times now.
Somebody once said to live in the relative world with the mind of emptiness. Mm-hmm. On my screen, she's right over there.
A great teacher.
I told him he couldn't say that. Was not old, because I get to say that next week.
I think about it all the time. It's great.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Jody had her hand up before.
Oh, sorry. Jody?
Yeah, I got a little tangled up in some of the verbiage on page 193 about.
Of which book? I gave you two books.
On page 193, from the Sound of Emptiness, the Heart of Sutra book, starting No Hindrance, where there's a discussion about wisdom, but then actually they say there is no wisdom. So there's some of that back and forth language, like, there's wisdom, but then actually there's no wisdom. So I kind of just had to I had to be real careful not to get tangled up on what the hell does that mean? Is there or is there not wisdom? And then it's like, I just had to kind of move on. But, and I've kind of moved on from that since I raised my hand. And on that same section of reading, there was something I underlined that really kind of caught my attention, kind of even more, or actually less frustrating so than the conversation about wisdom. But was this idea, he says here, no one is there. And he uses the phrase one a couple times in this one short piece, and I underlined it. And it made me think this idea, there is no kind of solid self. There's no solid Jody who's ever unchanging.
Yeah, would you like to read that paragraph for us?
Yeah, so it says the sutra up to this point has talked about the emptiness of all beings. If emptiness means everything is impermanent, so there's no unchanging self nature, seeing impermanence and egolessness is the wisdom called prajnaparamita. A consequence of this prajna is there is no one, and I underline and I emphasize one because that's how I read it. There is no one to see reality. No one is there. There is nothing we can gain through wisdom. Actually, there is no wisdom. If wisdom existed, wouldn't be really empty. The conclusion of wisdom, of prajna, is that there is no one who gains and nothing to be gained.
I would actually read that without emphasizing the one. Mm. I think it makes a lot more sense and is consistent with at least my practice not to emphasize the one. So starting halfway down, no one is there. There is nothing we can gain through wisdom. Actually, there is no wisdom. If wisdom existed, our practice wouldn't be really empty. The conclusion of wisdom, of prajna, is that there is no one who has gained and nothing to be gained. There's no one who gains and nothing to be gained. So it's just simply saying that our attachment to our conventional idea of self as separate can fall away with wisdom. That that we see that we're connected and that we're not permanent.
Right, I get that. I think I emphasize that, the one part, because I'm grappling still with this idea of this no unchangeable me. You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. I think I emphasize that to say there is no just one me. There's no one you. There's no one this. But I find following you.
Okay. I feel like I want to, I see there are more questions. Some of the questions may be answered as I'll just take, I'd like to take just one more and then move on if that's okay. Barbara Jung.
I just think that that paragraph explains the attainment question, that if there's no attainment and they attain, that it has to do with not they're, that the Buddhas are not doing it, they're understanding it, that their attainment is awakening to the reality of it, not achieving it or gaining it or grappling for it. So there's this, there's no one to attain. And then if there's no one, if you achieve that sense of no self, then you're, then that's the wisdom. That is the wisdom. But that it's a cyclic, like, anyway.
Cyclic. That's too close to putting a thing on, making it a thing. Yeah. That it feels like, and I know it's hard to talk about this, but to say, to use words like a person achieves something, I don't think that's what the Heart Sutra is teaching us. To me, the Heart Sutra is telling us that not only is there no me who's permanent and abiding, but that that very idea that I am impermanent and non-abiding is empty. Don't hold on to that either. So how could there be something to try to achieve or to attain? So I think that it's really easy to get the more radical part of this, form is emptiness. And then you say, oh, everything's empty. It's not that. Emptiness is form. So it's telling us don't get caught on emptiness either. Ideas about enlightenment, ideas about who gets enlightened, ideas is it me, is it some other self? What am I if I'm not? It goes back to there being relative truth and absolute truth. Yeah, I'm different than you. I have different thoughts than you. You have different thoughts than each other. We're not going to magically meld into each other. Form is form. But we also don't want to attach to that. And we don't want to attach to the way we're connected either. So I hope that's somewhat helpful. An interesting thing that the Heart Sutra continues with is that after it says, without any hindrance, no fears exist, it says, far apart from every perverted view, one dwells in nirvana. And I think we're being tricky again there, because nirvana is again, we don't want to think of it as a thing. And dwelling in nirvana doesn't mean that we're in some special place. I read to you last week that Okamura said that nirvana is not a special state of mind. It's really a commitment to just come back to each moment, just as it is. As Suzuki Roshi used to say, things as it is. And he said that apparently on purpose to emphasize both sides of the coin, all sides of the coin. But it's far apart from every perverted view, which is the important point here too, that a perverted view, Okamura says that is translated from the Japanese Tendo Muso, which means upside down thoughts in the dream. So how he explains that is that we're upside down because we think that our minds control this body, this world, what he calls the body mind. He says body mind serve the emperor thought. It's upside down to not let the world be what it is, rather than what we think it is or want it to be. And that brings me to a story. When I was first practicing, I went to Sojin Mel Weitzman, who was Mary's teacher, I was practicing at Berkeley Zen Center then. I went to see him in Dokusan, which is a private meeting with the teacher. Which I had asked, somebody, what do you do in Dokusan? They said, well, tell them what your practice is. And so I told him what my practice was. I told him, and I was thinking that this was a pretty clever practice I'd come up with. I said, observe the observer. That's what I was thinking to myself. I figured that if I would observe myself observing, I would eventually see what this thing was that was observing. I knew that we were working on, loosening the self. So I thought observe the observer was a very clever practice to do that. So I told him, I said, and I think observe the observer. And he said, no, don't do that. Almost like he was swatting a fly, it seemed like, don't do that. But it felt really powerful somehow for him to I was so wrong. He didn't even need to explain. He just said, don't do that. And then he told me that each breath, before he did, he told me each breath is the universe. But he told me that there's various things I could do. I could count my breath, or I could, mark it in some way mentally. I could go in my mind with each out breath. For the whole breath, stay focused on it. And he used the phrase, each breath is the universe. Well, I didn't really know what that meant. It made sense at the time. And then next time I sat, I was breathing and I was doing what I thought he'd asked. And so all of my thoughts came up. So I sort of, I'm not sure I really verbalized it this way to myself, but looking back on it, I was trying to drown my thoughts in the internal sound of my breath. So it's not so much, the breath can be fairly loud in your own head, especially if you haven't been taught, don't do any kind of yoga breath. So the breath is the universe. So I'll make it the universe. Mm-hmm. Well, of course that didn't work. Thoughts came back and I eventually realized, I think it was various things made me realize that wasn't how we practice. But one of the things I heard was Hozan, Alan Weitzman, who is now the current abbot of Berkeley Zen Center, said, not to me, but in general, he said, you want a soft focus on your breath, and you want a soft focus on the wall in front of you as you sit with your eyes open in Zazen, a soft focus on your thoughts or whatever is going on. Soft focus. So obviously that doesn't mean drown it all out with the sound of your breathing or with the thought of your breathing. And I think what he was talking about was also non-attachment to form and emptiness. It's a very simple thing. It's just sitting with the correct posture, with plenty of room for your breath to go to your hara, to your belly, and being with it every moment. And taking it with you. Not just on the cushion, on and off the cushion. It's harder to notice your breath off the cushion. Have you ever noticed that? Anybody find it easier? I would be very surprised if anyone raised their hand. Back to the homage to the Pranya Paramita. It says the she herself is an organ of vision. She has a clear knowledge of the own being of all dharmas, for she does not stray away from it. Isn't that about being with it, whatever it is? So if we want to be empty, maybe we're not really with what is. Pretty sure I mentioned this before, that can be called spiritual bypass, when you try to be completely in the absolute. Well, good luck. And even then, you probably wouldn't be able to function. So that's not what we're trying to do. We're also not trying to stay close to form, because that would be delusion. Stay close to form would be to be caught up with all my desires, everything I want. I'm going to live for the moment. I'm going to just, if I want something, I'm going to get it. Good luck with that too, right? But stay close. Stay close to not the thoughts. Again, not the thought, the emperor in the mind, the emperor of body and mind, but with experience. Stay close with breathing, with the soft focus. And we can let it be our universe. I'm going to do a flashback to that Dokusan encounter with Sojin and tell you something he read to me that didn't make sense to me then. And I was sort of complimented that he did, he actually had it memorized. This is from Dogen, from the Ginjo Koan. A lot of you might've heard this. When I was saying, observe the observer, Sojin said, well, Dogen said that to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. When actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. No trace of realization remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. Shall I read it again? To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. When actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the body and minds of others, drop away. No trace of realization remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. So that's what we're doing. When we, whether we're on the cushion or we're taking our zazen into the world, we're taking the world into our zazen on the cushion. We're studying the self. And as we study, we're not making an effort to forget who we are. We're noticing who we are and what's going on inside. And around us too. as Zach wisely said one time, he learned the difference between listening to the birds when he's sitting zazen or hearing them. Is that a fair thing of what you, fair representation of what you said, Zach? You can just this or, you know. You forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things. This guy in here is the trouble, as they say sometimes. The emperor of the body and mind. Be actualized by the myriad things rather than force your way on them through your own thinking. When actualized by the myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. Form is emptiness. No trace of realization remains, and this no trace can be endlessly. Emptiness is form. No holding on to whatever, to the experience, however big or small, however trivial or magnificent. The Heart Sutra goes on to say, in the three worlds, all Buddhas depend on Pranya Paramita and attain unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. So, complete, perfect enlightenment attaining perfect enlightenment is to attain nothing, is to just make a commitment to be present for whatever happens. Okamura, I mentioned this in my lecture, he talked about bouncing back and forth between realization of wisdom and not wisdom. Being okay with that too. And being okay with wisdom being not having wisdom. There's a deep sense in which we're not attaining wisdom at all. Wisdom is nothing to attain either. Has anybody experienced or had thoughts about ideas or non-ideas about being manifested by the myriad things? And I'm sorry to be a little bit glib about no ideas. What I really mean is I want either questions or thoughts or experiences. Lisa.
Just when you were reading it just now, just like I had this little ding moment. Like I just suddenly thought, oh, that's to be actualized by myriad things. I don't know if I can capture what my little ding light bulb was. It had to do with what also with Paula's question about depends, because everything is actually dependent, mm-hmm. right? So everything is dependently arising. So your self isn't, it's not about yourself. It's about the fact that, oh, you're constantly arising with everything. You're being actualized by everything. If you could forget the self, that would actually, yeah, that's what's getting in the way, right?
Yeah, And how do you forget the self?
Yeah, zazen, I guess.
Dogen says to study the self. I got into a quagmire in my mind about what depends means as well. And I was talking to Mary about that two nights ago, what depends on Pranya Paramita means. And it seemed that the best I I can come up with is that that's pretty much the same thing as doing zazen. Like, you can't, why do we say we do zazen? We say we do zazen, but that can sound like we're taking some effort that has our ego involved. And so it's one way we talk. We sit zazen, or does zazen sit us? Yeah, so go on. I just wanted to.
Yeah, I think it's the same thing. All Buddhas depend. It's like that's what makes a Buddha a Buddha, is the Prajnaparamita. Like, that's why it's not like depending on something, like I need this. It's just that's what actualizes a Buddha, I think. And that's zazen.
Yeah, that works for me. I want to see if some people have questions who haven't spoken. Some people, I won't be mean and call on you, but if you know who you are, if you haven't spoken, I want you to please have a chance to ask any questions or give any feedback or thoughts. Well, I might be mean and call on someone. Wayne, I don't think I've heard from you in two classes, so I am going to call on you. How do you feel about the class?
I'm along for the ride. It's I'm thinking about it a lot. I mean, maybe I'm not supposed to be thinking about it, but, you know, the space, I've been thinking about space, spaces between people, spaces within ourselves, spaces within our bodies. And, but it's a lot. I mean, I don't know what else to say. I'm taking it all in. I think, yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Kelly.
I'm still hung up on that translation of the word perverted, or the perverted world view. And here's what hung me up was, correct me if I'm wrong, the translation was upside down in a dream.
Upside down thoughts in a dream.
Yeah, which is not nearly as mean. and so I'm wondering, is it meaning to be, does the translation comes out derogatory, it comes out mean, but I'm wondering
perverted is mean.
Yeah, perverted is, it sounds mean to me.
Let's try to find the exact page that's on so we can read together what exactly Okamura says. But yeah, please go on.
Yeah, and I was just like, well, when I read that line in the Heart Sutra, I think perverted worldview, that's coming down on a worldview. That's like, man, this is not right. But, you know, upside down thoughts in the dream actually sounds kind of lovely.
Well, I don't think it probably sounds lovely. I found the page, I just got a message that San Francisco Zen Center uses inverted, which actually sounds much closer to what Okamura says. Far apart from every inverted view, one dwells in nirvana. Yeah. So I'll read you exactly what Okamura says here. And I think that since he's translating from the Japanese, we can probably think about whether perverted is the right word or not.
Okay.
But he writes on the bottom of page 195, the last paragraph. The sutra tells us that the bodhisattva dwells far apart from every perverted view. The expression in Japanese is tendo muso. Here mu means dream, and so means thinking. Muso literally means thought in a dream. Tendo means upside down. Our attitude or understanding of a thought in a dream is upside down. We cannot wake up. We are thinking in a dream. We create our own picture of the world depending on our karma or experience. Our experience is very limited, and yet we think it is the whole world. So we are like the frog in the well. We only see a small circle of sky, but we think we are seeing the whole universe. Even seeing emptiness doesn't allow us to see the whole universe, but it enables us to realize that our view is limited. And he goes on to talk about how we can't see what's behind us, and a metaphor for not being able to see the whole universe. We can only see our own perspective. Does that help, Kelly?
Yeah, a little bit. I think the way I'm sort of taking it is that the word perverted is probably harsher than it's meant to be, at least to my ears.
Yeah, it sounds harsh to me too. And it has a sort of maybe old world feel to it in a way. Like it seemed like it's a choice was probably made to use a certain flavor of the language.
Right.
And I would have to look more into that to have a sense of why perverted was used and if it would be better to use inverted or something else. Yeah, right. So I think it's really interesting that San Francisco has now moved on and is using inverted.
Yeah, it sounds like it makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
Dana, how's the class for you?
Thank you, Steve. Oh, just lots to think of course. I resonate a lot with Avalokiteshvara's story, with her head exploding. And all I can think of is beings are numberless and I vow to save them. It's just in my head. And I think it resonates because, and I know you're not supposed to talk about your experiences of meditating, so you don't concretize them. But years ago, when I first started practicing Tonglen at the time, someone taught me this, and I was totally unprepared for that experience of connecting to suffering of everyone out it kind of just happened. And, I did feel like my head
explained. Explain a little what Tonglen is. I'll bet not everybody knows.
I think it's called Lojong in other traditions.
Well, no, it's okay. Just in your own words. In your own words.
Just to breathe in suffering and breathe out peace for yourself, for loved ones, for others in the world. And the first time I tried this, I wasn't really prepared for the connection, and I just had a really strong vision of people pressing like against a membrane, like in hell, like begging to be seen, and I won't go into it because I don't want to concretize it more, but I was really unprepared for the vision, and kind of angry at this teacher about that, not preparing us for that. Oh, that was just my experience. Is it? And but it made me realize that you know, when we say our vow, we say a vow, or we say beings are numberless and we vow to save them, and yet at the same time we really can we? I want to. I do. And if that just means I'm not such an asshole today. No, that okay. I did that, you know, but I don't know. That's what the Har Sutra brings up for me is that meaty part there that I think we aspire to, I hope to aspire to, just by showing up and showing up again and again, I guess. And to me, also, the word dynamic comes into mind, because as we try to pin words to everything, it's just to me, this constant process that just is like water flowing. Everything about the sutra is just flowing, and we just kind of agree to flow with it, I think.
Yeah, and I think it's okay to come up with words to describe our experiences. I mean, we have to. Was it Uchiyama Roshi who had one book called Returning to Silence? Who was it?
Katagiri.
Thank you. Katagiri Roshi had a wonderful book called Returning to Silence. And then his next book was, you got to say something, or you have to say something. And again, here we are, not getting caught in the relative or the absolute truth, knowing not only is form emptiness, but emptiness is form. Zach, I think this will be the last question because we're almost at time. You had your hands in Gassho? Or maybe I misunderstood. Oh, you didn't? Okay. So speaking of the beings are numberless and bowing to save them. Unless there's any last question. Raymond.
Yeah, there was one thing, and it gets back to the dialogue that you had with Kelly and the issue of perverted. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at some of the descriptions in the Heart Sutra book, and also from the where you read that description. And as I hear it in my mind, we're dwelling far apart from every perverted view, and then pulling it over to where the book is, and it talks about how the experience of sunyata that transcends that the manipulative gestures which societal conditioning in its ignorance sees, and then it goes on a little bit further.
Where are you?
Oh, I was pulling that out of page 49 of the book of the Heart Sutra book. That little
we have two. I gave you two books. Which is it, Okamura or the Tiger's Cave? Hold it closer. I can't see it.
That's okay.
I know which one that is.
That's the most calm he's looking at.
So I was looking at both of them. I was looking at the one that you sent, the Sound of Emptiness Heart Sutra on page 195 that you just read. And I was then looking at the Heart Sutra book. Where I was going with this is just really simply this, is that as we experience this hard day in January 6th, and I want to bring it to our reality.
Yeah.
Where there were a lot of people with, I would say, perverted thoughts that got caught up in the illusions and the manipulative gestures of so much that they bought into it and then acted on that, those perverted thoughts. And the thing is that what happens, it seems like what going into dwelling within this non-clouded mind of a bodhisattva, you don't get caught up into being manipulated and pushed into events that are against all of the of the unclouded and better self, and so that's why I don't think it's so much in, I mean, whether it's inverted or perverted, the fact of the matter is that you are living in a clouded world and you're not seeing truth. Anyway, that's where I was going. And I know we're running out of time, so I didn't want to dwell.
Yeah. And
do you have a thought about that?
My thought is that I agree that thoughts can cause so much suffering and can cause action that causes suffering, such as January 6th and that event, the insurrection attempts. And it also means that we can learn to see the people who are swept away by their thoughts as human beings and as beings who are in this world with us, and to respond appropriately to them and not assume that they're inhuman monsters of some kind, or even pity can be a trap. You know, it's a way of thinking of ourselves as better than other people. So to somehow, you know, condemn the actions, but still see our shared humanity. And I think that's part of wisdom is to see that and to stay close to it and stay close to our conflicted feelings. I mean, the reason I bring up pity and all that stuff is because those came up for me first. Those are my real emotions. So stay close to those too, you know. Yeah, it's hard and it's important. These things have real world consequences. So thanks for bringing that up. Okay, I think we're ready to close. I think I'm not going to say unless. Kate, please do the honors.
And then I have some homework to tell you about, but let's go ahead and conclude this class.
Of course.
An unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.
So, housekeeping and homework.
I would like to ask you please to read the Heart Sutra to yourself, chant it if you will, read it every day for this coming week, and I'll send you a few pages, I think, but what we're talking about next time is we'll go very fast through the how it's supreme and absolute and the best one, which Okabora also, I found kind of offensive, but we'll go with the Prajnaparamita and the Gate. So we'll just talk about it some more. And I'll ask you what you think the Art Sutra is about. Yeah? Did you have a... Okay. Because you're muted. All right. I'm done.
Were there any other housekeeping items before we finish up for the night?